This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Konstantin von Hofmeister. We're going to be talking about India. Konstantin, great having you back on.
Yeah, thanks for having me again. I greatly appreciate it.
Konstantin, you lived in India and you worked there as a journalist for two different newspapers, one in Bombay and the other in New Delhi.
Well, that's correct. I worked for two English language Indian newspapers. The one in Bombay, which is now called Mumbai, but I refuse to use the new name. I prefer the old British name, Bombay. Was called Blitz. It was a weekly newspaper. And yeah, it was called Blitz because the owner of the newspaper was some old Indian guy. He was obsessed with Adolf Hitler and World War II history, and he really liked the German word Blitzkrieg, and he thought it has a nice ring to it. So, and also Blitz means lightning or flash in German, so it's like a news flash, like the latest news basically, so that's why he called the newspaper Blitz. And as I mentioned earlier, it was a weekly newspaper in color, so they had a lot of, like, I don't know, travel writing and features on artists and actors, etc. And the one in New Delhi was just a regular daily newspaper. It was called National Herald.
So it wasn't, the writing wasn't, it wasn't like dissident, extreme right-wing writing. He just picked the name because of his interest, but it was, you'd say it's generally a mainstream newspaper?
Yeah, 100% mainstream. Nothing controversial.
And what was the general theme of your writings?
Well, I wrote different things. Like, I wrote, for Blitz, I wrote a lot of travel articles. I traveled all over India and basically wrote, like, travel reports with pictures of my experiences as a foreigner in the different states and in different parts. And I also wrote film reviews and book reviews, play reviews, and I was also interviewed, I know, various artists, actors from Bollywood that I met. And for National Herald in New Delhi, yeah, I also wrote some travel pieces, but I also wrote just regular political writings. And I interviewed various famous people like Sonia Gandhi and the Dalai Lama.
Oh, well, you interviewed the Dalai Lama. He was in the news several months ago where his statement about, forget what he said, something about the migrant crisis in Europe.
Yeah, I think didn't he say that all the migrants should go back and basically Europe belongs to the Europeans?
Yeah, but it's fascinating because a lot of white liberals are really obsessed with the Dalai Lama. But, he's basically a Tibetan nationalist.
Well, of course he's a Tibetan nationalist because he's the spiritual and the head of the Tibetan state, basically, which now doesn't exist because it's part of China. And that's why he's in exile in India. But he doesn't recognize Chinese rule. So he wants Tibet to be independent, of course. And he views the Tibetans as an autonomous people that should be free and not ruled by a foreign race or a foreign people.
what was your initial impression of the Dalai Lama, and what did you discuss with him?
Well, actually, I attended a conference that was in 1999, so it was almost 20 years ago when I lived in New Delhi, and the Dalai Lama gave a speech on the spiritual relationship between India and Tibet, because the Buddha, he was born in India, he was an Indian prince, and Buddhism, the religion, or the philosophy, whatever you want to call it, was therefore born in India, so it's originated in India, and then spread to different parts of the world, including Tibet. And he was talking about this, that the Tibetan people owe so much spiritually to India, because the Buddha was Indian and he was from India. And after the conference, after his speech, there was a press conference. So a lot of journalists were present from different newspapers and TV stations, including me, because I had a press pass. And all the journalists were allowed to ask, like, I don't know, several questions. So that's how I got to communicate with him. And I would say I was very surprised. He was very soft-spoken. And if I remember correctly, his English was impeccable, like impeccable British English with as an Oxford accent, like some Oxford professor. That's what he sounded like.
And you also interviewed, is that Gandhi's granddaughter?
Yeah, Sonia Gandhi, but she's not related to Mahatma Gandhi. Sonia Gandhi is Italian. She's not even Indian. She was married to Indira Gandhi. She was the Prime Minister of India. And Sonia Gandhi is the Italian wife of Indira Gandhi's son. Because Indira Gandhi's son, I think he went to Italy on vacation or something and met her, fell in love. He brought her back to India. They got married. And after Indira Gandhi was assassinated by her Sikh bodyguards because of the Sikh uprising in Amritsar that she had ruthlessly crushed, her son became the Prime Minister of India, but then he also was assassinated. And Sonia Gandhi, Italian national, never went back to Italy, just stayed in India basically, and stayed in Indian politics, in the Congress Party, and she's still active now in India in politics. And I think her son, who's I guess also partly Italian, half Italian, is also a big figure now in Indian politics, in the Congress Party.
And this newspaper, it was an English language newspaper?
Yeah, well, English language newspapers. Because English is an official language of India. So I think it's Hindi and English are the two official languages.
It unites the nation, the English language, because there's a Hindi, a Punjabi, all these different smaller obscure languages, so it creates a cohesive language for the nation.
Yeah, I would say so, because like Hindi is mostly spoken in northern India, because if you go to like southern India, you have, say, Tamil Nadu, you have the Madras, which is now called Chennai, which is also a huge city in the south, but basically it's in the state of Tamil Nadu, but nobody speaks Hindi. There are very few people speak Hindi because everybody speaks Tamil. So they even have their own film industry, because you have Bollywood, which is centered in Bombay. So they have the Hindi language films. But they're not very popular in South India and Tamil Nadu because nobody really speaks Hindi. So they have their own film industry in Chennai, in this city. So they make the Tamil films. And yeah, so I would say a lot of... And they're not related at all. I mean, Hindi and Tamil, as far as I know. So it's not like they're similar, like Russian and Ukrainian. I think they're completely different. So a Tamil-speaking person can't understand a Hindi-speaking person at all, and vice versa. So I think, yes, the common language would be English.
A misconception about India is that it's one ethnicity or nationality, because with the Chinese, they view themselves as like this one group, the Han Chinese. With India, it's many different smaller ethnic groups. So it's a misconception to view India as one nationality?
Well, as far as I know, Hindi is an Indo-European language. So I would say Hindi is related to, say, English, German, Russian, because all Indo-European languages. But Tamil, the language in Tamil Nadu, is not an Indo-European language. I think it's a Dravidian language. So it's like a proto-Indian language. So a language that was spoken in India, or has its roots in the Dravidians, and I think the Dravidians are the indigenous people in South India before the Aryans came. So because like Hindi, I think the language Hindi directly derives from Sanskrit, and Sanskrit is an Aryan language, Indo-European language. I think the Aryans brought the language. But I guess in South India, you have the original languages that were spoken before the Aryan invasion. That's why Hindi, I think, linguistically speaking, is more closely related to English than to Tamil, because both English and Hindi are Indo-European languages, but Tamil is not. And another interesting fact, like the national anthem of India, do you know which language it is sung in?
English?
No, it can't be English. It's a colonial language. It would be a big insult.
Hindi.
Well, it can't be Hindi, because you're insulting the South Indians because they don't speak Hindi. So, any other idea?
One of the Tamil languages?
Yeah, but then you'd insult the Hindi speakers. So they had to use a dead language. So it's Sanskrit they use, because Sanskrit is a dead language and nobody speaks it like Latin in Europe. So the national anthem of India is sung in Sanskrit for this reason, because Sanskrit is a big cultural heritage of India, like Latin is ancient Greek is a big cultural legacy of Western Europe. So Sanskrit in India, that's why it's in Sanskrit. So they don't want to favor any living languages in India. That's why they chose Sanskrit.
How noticeable is the Indo-European versus Dravidian divide in India today?
Well, it's extremely noticeable, because if you go to South India, like Tamil Nadu, Chennai, where I also lived for about a year doing other things, not journalism, well, people are noticeably darker, sometimes like, well, extremely dark. And in, say, northern India, like in the state of Maharashtra, where Bombay is located, people are generally more light-skinned. But even there, you have different degrees. Like, you have, like, I don't know, dark brown, light brown, and almost white.
There's some people in India who could pass for European.
Yeah, I would say that. Yeah, I would say maybe some Bollywood actors, but even they don't. I mean, they're very fair-skinned, but I wouldn't confuse them for Europeans. I think the only people in India that I can think of that could pass 100% as Europeans are the Parsis. And those guys are mostly located in Bombay as well. Because the Parsis are basically Persians, Zoroastrians, so they believe in the ancient fire religion, Zarathustra, and Ahura Mazda. The dualist religion. So Zarathustra is the light, Ahura Mazda is the dark. And these people were persecuted in Persia after Islam took over, because they refused to convert. So they became refugees and went to India. They basically escaped Persia because they didn't want to submit to Allah, and they wanted to continue to practice their Zoroastrian religion. And India was very tolerant, so they accepted them. And it was several hundred years ago. And I think originally they migrated from Persia to the state of Gujarat. But now most of them are located in Bombay. And I would compare the Parsis, with the word Parsi comes from the word Persian. I would compare them to the Jews, because like the Jews are the most successful people in the West, especially America. They're the most influential people in the world of business, in the world of politics, etc. So the Parsis in India, so they own all the huge companies. They're all very successful, quite rich, etc. And they like to stick together. They really don't want to like intermix too much with the general Indian populace. So they want to keep among themselves. Even though, like with the Jews in America, there's a lot of intermarrying going on now between Parsis and non-Parsis.
What groups and ethnic groups or caste did you socialize with the most?
Oh, I don't know, all kinds. I don't know. I didn't ask people for what caste they were.
Are some groups, like religious or cultural ethnic groups, more pro-Western than others?
Well, it's again, I have to go back to the Parsis. I think the Parsis are the most pro-Western Indians, extreme Anglophiles, because even during the Raj, during the colonial times, when the Indians were basically discriminated against in their own country, the Parsis were not. So the British did not treat the Parsis like they treated the rest of the Indians. So the British treated the Parsis more like fellow Europeans almost, or fellow white people. So you had like certain hotels or certain areas in colonial India where only white people were allowed, but not the native Indians. But Parsis were always counted as white people and were allowed to frequent these places. And I think because of this, they still have this real strong Anglophilia, because I know a lot of Parsis personally in Bombay and was often invited to their parties and everything. And even at home, they prefer to speak English. But like regular Indians, usually at home, don't speak English. They usually speak their local language, like I know Marathi in Maharashtra or Tamil in Tamil Nadu, depending on the state. So I would say most Indians, well, a lot of Indians in North India are trilingual.
Are there any groups in India that have a strong resentment against the West?
Yeah, not really. You know, I don't know, personally, I've never encountered such people because, not even against British people, like, you know, it's like some kind of, like, resentment because they were called. I mean, it exists, I suppose, like, in certain left-wing circles in India, but, like, in the general population, I've never experienced it. Be honest, like even as a white Westerner like me traveling around India, I would say that I was treated better because I was white than their fellow natives by Indians.
It's kind of a fascinating dichotomy because when Indians are in India, they tend to be more pro-Western, but then when they become immigrants to the West, some of them engage in that kind of a anti-white resentment politics.
Yeah, it's very strange. Yeah, I don't really understand it because like in India, I would say they're extremely pro-white and like you said pro-Western, but not pro-Western in the sense that they want to appropriate Western culture like movies or music because they still prefer their own music, their own movies and everything. Like if you go to a regular Indian cinema in any Indian city, like 90% or 95% of the movies will be Indian movies. Very, very few American movies are shown. And those usually only in the big cities like Bombay or Delhi. But even there, these movies are in the minority and the average Indian is more interested in Bollywood productions and even like, I don't know, Bollywood songs and Indian songs, pop songs, not so much Western songs, like even in the clubs or bars.
So I don't think the issue is so much India per se. I think a lot of groups have adopted different mentality when they're in a diaspora as opposed to their own country.
Yeah, maybe it's because, like the Indians say in America, they somehow don't feel that they're not in the majority, and therefore they cling even stronger to their roots.
You see that parallel with a lot of different groups. Have you noticed that in any other non-Western societies you visited?
What exactly?
The whole trend where people adopt a different mentality in a diaspora as they would in their own country. Because in their own country, they're comfortable, they're with their own people, so they have a more nationalist mindset. When someone moves to the West, they have this mentality that they're an outsider. And then on top of that, there's also the indoctrination in the media and in academia to have this kind of a resentment against Europeans.
So, I mean, the only people that I can think of are, like, say, people from all these Muslim countries, like Pakistan, Syria, and Iran, because I've been to Pakistan. And in Pakistan, the people are very friendly, very hospitable, very open, very nice. You know, it's like, I had no problems with anybody. I felt perfectly comfortable, perfectly safe. I mean, that was 1999 when I was there, so it's probably maybe a bit different now because it was before September 11 and before the war on terror and everything, before everybody became hysterical. But I think, in general, like, yeah, people are very nice, but if you read reports about, say, what's going on in Germany now with the so-called refugee crisis, you have a lot of people from these countries, including Pakistan, and Syria, and Iran, Afghanistan, etc. And, like, almost on a daily basis now, like, every 2 days, you read some news story from Germany, like, an Afghan guy stabbed a kid in the neck, five Pakistanis raped some girl in the bushes somewhere, and so on, killed her, etc. Why? You know, do they do this in Pakistan as well on a daily basis? Maybe not, I'm not so sure. But I think it's a culture clash, you know, because in Pakistan, they're in this strictly regulated theocratic society where religion dominates everything. And then they come to the West where it's completely liberal and people don't believe in anything and maybe they just can't cope with it. And they feel that they're superior because they have this strict religious moral code and they just view, say, Westerners, especially Western women, as like cattle, like garbage that they can just treat like that, basically.
I've noticed that trend with a lot of groups. I mean, even the same could be said about Mexico, because in Mexico, there's resentment against the United States, but there's not really an anti-white culture. I haven't been to Mexico, but I've talked to people from there or have lived there, and then immigrants come here and they adopt these ideologies. So yeah, it's basically there's like a sort of this like diaspora mentality, and I think it's not really accurate to say that reflects the nation itself within India. So you would view, as far as geopolitics go and alliances go, you would view India as an ally to the West in general?
Yeah, well, yeah, I would say because India and Europe, they have common roots, like the Aryan roots, basically. It's like spiritually and philosophically, like they're very closely connected, say Europeans and Indians. And Indians like to stress this fact all the time, you know, the common Aryan heritage, they love it, you know. That's why you can buy, say, Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf on every street corner, and sometimes you even see, I don't know, pictures of Hitler. The swastikas you see everywhere anyway in India, because it's a religious Hindu symbol, so nothing to do with the Nazis. But the Nazis themselves and Hitler is generally portrayed either positively or just in a neutral way. Very rarely have I met Indians that really hate Nazis or hate Hitler or hate this part of European history or German history. So I really think they believe like Hitler was a good guy because he stressed this concept of Aryanism that the Indians also embrace. That's why you have people like Savitri Devi, that crazy Greek woman who was married to a Brahmin in I think 1930s, and then lived in India, became fascinated with NS ideology, with Nazi ideology, because of this idea of Hinduism as Aryan paganism and India being the last country in the world where Aryan paganism is still alive, because according to her, in Europe, it was already supplanted with this Semitic desert religion called Christianity. And Aryan paganism in Europe is pretty much dead, but in India it's still alive, according to her. And she admired Hitler and the Nazis because she believed that they wanted to revive this Aryan tradition in Europe that was still alive in India. And she thought that the Nazi Germany or the Nazis in general were natural allies of India. And her hope was that the Nazis would win the war and then march into India, kick out the British, and create this new global Aryan order with Germany and India at its heart.
With India's role with, there's China and then there's the Muslim world. So India has their main adversary is Pakistan, but what is their general attitude towards both China and to the Muslim world?
Well, it's very negative, of course. I mean, Indians really, in general, like from my experience, from what I observe, talking to a lot of Indians, I think China is viewed very, very negatively by most Indians, because they also had a lot of border conflicts and everything, and they view China as the main rival because they're right next to China. And the two cultures are too different. And it's an economic rival as well, because both India's economy is growing, China's economy is growing. Of course, China's economy is growing a lot faster and China is a lot more prosperous than India. So I think they're viewed as a main threat. Also, the Chinese people are way too different. Like for Indians, the Chinese people are like aliens, basically, like too weird, because they eat insects and all these other weird crap. And Indians don't understand it. They can't relate to it because Indians don't do this. They don't eat insects and eat these weird things. So that's why I think Indians feel much closer to the West than, say, to China. And with the Muslim world, we don't even have to mention the Muslim world. I mean, because India is a majority, I mean, still a majority Hindu nation. And they always view the Muslims with suspicion, especially because of the whole Pakistan issue. Because the Pakistanis are basically Indians. I mean, it's an artificial divide because it used to be one country and the British just like, you know, like drew the border on the map and said all the Muslims now move to India. Sorry, all the Muslims now move to Pakistan and all the Hindus move to India. And that created this huge conflict where, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of people died as a result because Hindus and Muslims, they really don't get along.
And with China, they have this Silk Road project, which would completely encircle India. So it would be highways and ports in Bangladesh, Pakistan, and Sri Lanka. So I'm sure India is not too pleased about that.
No, of course not. No, I think India views it as a very, very, very big threat. So I think India is looking for allies wherever it can. Find them strong allies like Russia, United States, and Israel as well, because Israel is viewed extremely positively by most Indians, including Indian politicians. I think it's also because of the Muslim issue, to be honest, because Indians can relate to Israel, because Israel is also surrounded by all these Muslim nations, and India feels a threat also from Pakistan. And maybe Bangladesh to the south as well, which is also Muslim, because Bangladesh used to be called East Pakistan. I mean, it was part of Pakistan originally.
With the whole sort of Indo-European versus Dravidian divide, the north versus south, so there's a general perception that the Indo-Europeans in the north are wealthier. As far as wealth disparities go, is the north generally more prosperous? Is it more... complex of that, because I've heard that a lot of the Indians who come to work in the Silicon Valley, they're disproportionately Tamil Brahmins. With the whole tech industry in Hyderabad, that's sort of the central area.
Yeah, Hyderabad and Bangalore, because Bangalore is like, I mean, they call Bangalore the Silicon Valley of India. You have all these call centers there in the IT industry. Same with Hyderabad. And yeah, I'm not so sure if the North is more prosperous, to be honest. Like, I don't know the statistics, like, but I know that, for example, like the state of Kerala, which is on the East Coast, also has beautiful beaches and everything, is the richest state in India with the best infrastructure and the highest rate of literacy. And all the wealth, of course, is in Bombay, because Bombay is the financial center, the financial capital of India, not the political capital, which is Delhi, but like all the money, all the banks, financial institutions, all, I know, located and centered in Bombay.
A lot of people just sort of generally assume this perception of India that the like lighter complexion people are wealthier. Is that too simplistic? Is it more complex than that?
Yeah, I would say it's more complex than that, because I mean, I met a lot of, say, light complexion people in Mumbai and Delhi that are fairly rich, but I also met a lot of, like, say, darker-skinned Dravidians in Chennai when I lived there. They were also quite rich, so I'm not sure about percentages, to be honest. I mean, because Chennai is, you also have a lot of rich people there, a lot of rich Dravidians as well. But in general, I think it's true, because in general, like, say, in North India, the lighter-skinned people are usually from the Brahmin caste, like the priest caste originally. They didn't want to intermix with the darker-skinned people, and they tried to keep their bloodlines pure, and they were already rich hundreds of years ago, and I guess the wealth somehow just stayed in the family.
As far as cuisine goes, do you generally have a preference for Northern versus Southern Indian cuisine? I'm not a big expert on Indian food, but I guess Northern Indian food is more heavy on garlic. And I guess that's probably, I'm trying to think about what I've had in the United States, I'm probably guessing more Northern food. I think I did have a Southern dish once. It was this coconut curry that was very spicy. Can you comment on the differences in regional cuisine and what your preferences are?
Well, my preferences are a Northern Indian cuisine. And I think in, say, in the West, like Indian restaurants in, say, Europe and the United States, it's, I would say, 95% of the time, it's all North Indian cuisine, like all the famous stuff, like tandoori chicken, chicken tikka, the stuff that is, the chicken that is cooked in this clay oven that gives it its unique and distinct taste. And you have the
non-bread.
What about,
non-bread is Northern?
Yes, Northern, which is also cooked in the tandoor oven where the chicken's cooked, that gives it its unique flavor, and that's why you can't cook it at home unless you have a clay oven at home. You can never recreate the flavor. I mean, this unique flavor of, say, tandoori chicken and naan bread comes from the clay oven. So if you go to an Indian restaurant that doesn't have this oven, you can immediately taste it, that it wasn't cooked in that oven. So that's why you can't really make it at home. Like, you can make it at home, but it's not the same thing. Because it's called tandoori chicken because it's made in a tandoor oven, which is the clay oven, and that's North Indian cuisine.
What about that spinach dish, palak paneer, with the spinach and spicy? It's spicy with cheese.
Yeah, I think it's also North Indian. And interesting enough, I don't know if you're familiar with chicken tikka. Chicken tikka is basically the same as tandoori chicken. The only difference is that tandoori chicken tikka is boneless. It's basically boneless tandoori chicken. And now you have chicken tikka masala, and masala means sauce. So it's basically chicken tikka with sauce. That was actually a British invention. So because when the British ruled India, they also enjoyed Indian cuisine. And I guess some Brits, they ate some chicken tikka and they said, oh, it's too dry. You know, I need some sauce. So chicken tikka masala was invented by the Brits. And now it's like the most popular dish in all the Indian restaurants in the world, including in India itself. Another thing the British invented, talking about Indian cuisine, is a mint sauce. Because every time you order tandoori chicken in an Indian restaurant, it doesn't matter if it's in India or New York.
Is that the one? It's the yogurt with mint and cucumber?
Yeah, that's it, exactly. No, you're talking about raita. I'm just talking about mint sauce. There's no cucumbers in it, just mint sauce. And it's usually served with a tandoori chicken. So if you order tandoori chicken in your restaurant, doesn't matter if it's in Bombay, New York, or London, it usually comes with mint sauce. And there's also a British thing, because the British love mint, so the British introduced this in India as well. South India is more vegetarian than North India, so it's I would say almost 100%. I mean, they have some meat dishes, but it's almost exclusively vegetarian. They have this, what is called masala dosa, where you have like this big round metal plate with different sauces and different vegetables, pickled stuff, and you have some really flat bread kind of thing where you dip it in and eat it. It's also very delicious. It's also very tasty.
And raita is Northern Indian.
Yeah, I think it's Northern Indian, but you can also get it in the South. Like, I think it's pretty much popular everywhere. And I think the reason why it's so popular is to neutralize the spiciness of the food, because Indians love it spicy. And you know that milk and yogurt neutralizes sort of the effect that the spices have on you. And that's why usually when they eat spicy food, they usually have raita next to it. So it's not as painful, I guess, when they eat it.
Yeah, it's soothing on your stomach.
Exactly.
Yeah, I would probably say most of the Indian food I've had in the United States is probably more northern. But if you go to a restaurant, they usually don't specialize the region. What about are mango lassis popular?
Yeah, it's super popular. I get them everywhere. Yes, I used to drink them all the time when I was in India. Very nice.
Yeah, they're really good.
Healthy and delicious.
How much of a concern about getting food poisoning is there?
Well, there's always a concern. I got food poisoning all the time when I lived in India. I would say once every 2 weeks, sometimes once a week. It's completely normal, you know. Diarrhea, stomach ache, you know. Yeah, but it doesn't matter. I mean, you can be really careful, only drink bottled water, only go to good restaurants, but all it takes is for some waiter, say, in a 5-star hotel to scratch his ass and then touch your plate and then put food on it. You already have the stomach virus and then you get the shit, so can't do anything, can't be avoided, to be honest.
So there's pretty bad sanitation as far as sewage goes and plumbing. I mean, there's this whole kind of meme about the designated shitting streets. How much of a problem is that?
But you should probably see it everywhere. You can just take any train in India from one city to another and look out the window and at like 6 in the morning, you see all the workers, all the field workers, the farm workers, or even factory workers shitting right next to the tracks. You can observe them, or you can drive through the slums in Bombay. And Bombay is the largest slum in Asia. And when you land at the international airport in Bombay, to go from the airport to the center, the main road goes right through the slums. And you just have to look out the window, you see people shooting left and right, and because there is no plumbing in the slums and no running water, so they just do everything on the side of the road with buckets, you know, as showers, and shitting on the curb, basically. And it's the same in the fields, like when you take a train across the country, you see people shitting on the fields, like at the early in the morning before they start work. That is very common. I would say India is extremely dirty, probably the dirtiest country I've ever been to in my life. Very dirty. Crowded, smelly.
Probably more so than any other place, with the possible exception of the densely populated parts of Africa.
Yeah, I can't imagine like these places in Africa being any worse, to be honest. I've never been to these places in Africa, so I don't know, but I can't imagine anything being worse than some of the areas in India, and especially in the bigger cities that I've been to. I mean, even Indians in their own homes, like Hindus or Muslims, it's always impeccably clean. You have to take off your shoes before you enter. Everything's clean, I guess, but there's no like communal spirit. Like, people just don't care like what's happening outside of their apartment or outside of the house, on the street and everything. Because I think in like Western countries, especially Western Europe or United States, like, you have this communal spirit. Like, people actually care how the hallway looks, you know, in the house where your apartment's in, or how the street looks in front of your house. But in India, they have no concept of this. They don't care at all. They just care about their own personal space, and that's it.
Do you think the issue is that because India is a multicultural, multi-ethnic society with a caste system, people are less thinking about this strong, cohesive identity? Like, say Japan's a society that's very homogenous, and they're very more invested, a society that's more homogenous is invested in the public good, while a country like India, which is more fragmented and tribal, is going to be less so.
I think that could be one of the reasons. I agree with you.
Is India investing a lot in their improving their infrastructure, like highways and rail lines?
A lot, because like I said, like, when I was working for these newspapers, that was almost 20 years ago. But I've been back to India almost every year since. I was just in India last year, and a lot changed. A lot of new highways, new skyscrapers, improved city centers, even pedestrian streets, street lights, lighting, everything. Yeah, huge improvements have been made all last couple of years. Huge, massive improvements. And like every year I come back, I'm amazed at like how much more new stuff there is in terms of infrastructure, especially roads, especially highways.
And China now is just like wall-to-wall skyscrapers. Is India still in the early stages of building skyscrapers?
Well, it's definitely not like China, of course, because China is just ridiculous in this sense, you know. So I think, yeah, compared to China, it's in its infancy, but it's growing very fast. Like, there are also putting up skyscraper after skyscraper now, especially in the big cities in India, but not nearly like on the scale of China, of course.
You actually like skyscrapers. Why do you think a lot of people on the right wing of politics, the dissident right, have this irrational hatred of skyscrapers?
Yeah, because it's inhuman, it's totalitarian, it's Orwellian, and it's not traditional. It doesn't look like a cottage, doesn't look like a timbered house, and doesn't look like these Victorian postcards or these pretty Bavarian villages where the Nazis had their parades, you know. I think that's the reason. You know, it's just not traditional. It's modernist, it's communist, it's socialist, it is monstrous. I think that's what they believe, to be honest. As it's like, they believe it has this Orwellian, like, 1984 connotation, sort of like a dystopian vision, these skyscrapers, like the movie Blade Runner, for example. A lot of people on the right also associate skyscrapers with globalization, because they say that it makes different cultures in different places all over the world look exactly the same, because you have the same architects, the same designers erecting skyscrapers in Singapore, New York, and Paris. So they're all interchangeable. So they're not rooted in the ethnic group or in the national culture.
That's the thing, is a lot of skyscrapers, if they all kind of look the same, then they kind of symbolize neoliberalism or globalism. But there are examples of skyscrapers that embody the national spirit of a nation. So I mean, one example in the West would be the Art Deco skyscrapers in America. But you can build a futuristic architecture. You talk about this concept of national futurism. I think it implies to architecture, having architecture that is futuristic, but represents the aesthetic of a nation. And I've even seen that with some futuristic renderings in various countries.
Yeah, I completely agree. Like one example, because I live in Moscow now, and in Moscow they have these buildings from the 1930s called Stalin's Seven Sisters. I'm sure you're familiar with them. It's these seven skyscrapers.
Oh, yes.
This is a neo-Gothic architecture that Stalin had built, but it's very traditional. I mean, these skyscrapers, I mean, they're not interchangeable. Like they look completely, in place here in Moscow, and they really would look out of place, say, in London or New York. So they are pretty much rooted here, especially in this like socialist Soviet tradition that was the dominant culture at the time. And interestingly enough, I think a couple of years ago, like I believe like about 10 years ago, they built an eighth one, but not made out of stone and brick, but made out of glass and steel. So the outline is almost exactly the same as the other seven sisters, except it's very modern and futurist looking, but it still has the same kind of look like the other seven. And that's the kind of skyscraper that I'm talking about, like a traditional skyscraper. And I think the same, like you mentioned, in New York, you have like the Chrysler Building, for example. That is, for me, that's also a very unique skyscraper. I mean, it fits into New York. It's very European. It's very Western, even as gargoyles, you know, like a cathedral. It looks like it belongs in the West, but it would look out of place in Bombay, for example.
I know they are planning these futuristic self-contained cities. I've been reading about this in different various architectural blogs. I think the one I read about was in New Delhi, but maybe in Bombay as well. And it's sort of a way for the elites of those countries to escape a lot of the pollution and chaos, but I know they're more common in East Asia, but that's a fascinating development.
Yeah, but you have this everywhere. I mean, it's sort of like a gated community now. Like, I mean, you have this in Brazil, you have this now in Los Angeles, and on all the big cities, like in America, these gated communities where, and you have them in Moscow also, where the rich people live and normal people can't enter at all. And they live their own secluded, happy lives if they have the money.
But not so much like a generic suburban gated community, but these futuristic self-contained cities. So you might have several high-rises, like an indoor atrium with like a garden and recreational areas and a shopping area, and it's all kind of self-contained. And India is proposing some of those, I think, in New Delhi.
But they have them everywhere in India. They have them in Bombay as well. I mean, but what's the difference between those and a suburban gated community? It's basically like a suburban gated community for very rich people. People that don't want to associate with the filth and the dirt that the common people produce, that the common people have to live in, basically. That's all it is. I mean, it's for people who can afford to live such an exclusive lifestyle, to live in such a place. Which somehow reminds me of, say, like Guillaume Fay's vision of archaeo-futurism when he describes sort of like a future apartheid regime in the Euro-Siberian Empire, where basically the elite, the technocratic elite, lives in like these futuristic skyscraper utopian shining cities, and the majority of the population, the majority of the people, live in villages and toil the fields, basically in medieval conditions, and practice basically very primitive rituals, and don't have the same technological advancement that the elite enjoys in these cities. So it's like a two-tier society, basically, that Guillaume Fay envisions. But this is what is really happening in the world right now. I mean, with these projects that you just mentioned.
I think they could be great things if they were to benefit the middle class, but a lot of these projects, they just benefit a very small number of people.
They will never benefit the middle class, because the middle class won't be able to afford it. This is only for the very, I mean, for not even for rich people, but for very rich people. It's unaffordable for the common man. So instead of creating these islands, shouldn't the money be spent on basically improving the infrastructure of the place as a whole?
Yeah, something more like Le Corbusier's plan.
Well, exactly, like Le Corbusier's brilliant plan for Paris should be implemented on a global scale so the masses can benefit and not just the elite. So you need a more egalitarian concept. Not these islands, but you need to spread out the improvement, not have these brilliant islands, these beautiful islands. You have a more general improvement over a wider area.
And as far as Le Corbusier goes, he had a lot of projects in New Delhi. Can you talk about those particular ones?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with any projects he had in New Delhi. Like, I'm very familiar with Chandigarh, because Chandigarh is a city that is an artificial city that was designed by Corbusier from scratch, basically. And I think it's a checkerboard pattern, so all the streets are straight lines, and a lot of brutalist buildings, concrete brutalist buildings, especially the government buildings and the ministries. Yeah, quite beautiful, like very different than other organic Indian cities, because it was designed from scratch by Corbusier. It's quite famous, Chandigarh. And a lot of open spaces, wide streets, squares, and all very geometrical, like all very patterned, rectangular, and straight lines, sharp edges. Yeah, I recommend visiting this place.
So Le Corbusier's basic template is high density housing or high rise housing, but surrounded by gardens and park spaces that are communal, so it doesn't become too claustrophobic.
Yes, exactly. I mean, isn't that the same plan he had for Paris? Like a lot of, very wide streets, but a lot of streets, I mean, especially for his plans in Paris, went underground, and above the streets you had all like green areas, big parks, a lot of open spaces between the high rises. So it's not just high-rise after high-rise next to high-rise next to high-rise. You had high-rises, but with a lot of open space between them. I mean, that was his plan for Paris, as far as I know.
I don't support that plan for central Paris, but I think it would have been great if they did it for the inner-ring suburbs of central Paris, or sort of these run-down inner-ring suburbs of a lot of different cities. But the thing is, the public housing projects in the West were influenced by Le Corbusier, but the problem is a lot of his best ideas were not implemented. They were sort of a downgraded version of that.
Well, that's why they don't work. That's why these places are hellholes, basically, because you don't have these open spaces, and they're not really livable. They're not beautiful. Not like he envisioned it, because, I mean, he envisioned these high-rises, like big apartment blocks, basically, but with a lot of open space between them, and parks, and greenery, etc., and so on. And I've been to these banlieues in Paris now, where you have these apartment blocks, and it's not like, it's not really what he envisioned, in my opinion, because it's too crowded. I mean, it's block after block after block with not a lot of space between them.
With architecture, there's this genre of architecture, I think it's called Indo-Saracenic. And from the British, and it's a British take on more traditional Indian architecture. Some examples are the Victoria Memorial in Calcutta, and I think the Marble Palace also in Calcutta. And also think there's been some examples of that in England as well.
I think the most famous example, which is also a UNESCO World Heritage Site, is the Victoria train station in Bombay. I mean, that's the prime example, the number one example of Indo-Saracenic architecture, and that's why it's UNESCO. And Indo-Saracenic architecture is basically a mixture of European Gothic architecture and traditional Oriental Mughal Indian architecture. Very unique and immediately recognizable if you see one of these structures. I've visited tons of these Indo-Saracenic buildings in India. Like, a lot of Maharajas had their palaces built in this style during British colonial rule. I just visited one last year in the state of Maharashtra in, I forgot the name of the town, but yeah, quite beautiful. You can see the Gothic elements, but you can also see, it's basically like Oriental Gothic, I would call it, this Indo-Saracenic style. Yeah, it's very unique, and especially very unique to India, and very beautiful. Very ornate, very detailed, with a lot of like small figures, things hanging out, little things sticking out here and there.
The Taj Mahal is the sort of icon of India to the West. It was interesting as the Taj Mahal was built by the Muslim Mughal dynasty rather than the Hindus.
Yes, correct. Yes, it's a tomb. Like, it was built as a mausoleum for Shah Jahan's wife. And I mean, it is very beautiful. It's very impressive if you visit it. The white marble, you know, it's like just dazzles you when you first see it. But yeah, well, it's Mughal architecture, and you have a lot of Mughal architecture in India. And the Mughals were Muslims, and they basically were invaders. They imposed their rule on the native Indians, but they ruled India also for hundreds of years.
So it was an extension of the Persian Empire.
Well, basically, yes. But they became part of India because, like I said, they ruled India for quite a long time. So they became part of Indian history, in my opinion.
And as the Taj Mahal being the icon of India, because it's such a spectacular monument, people are willing to look past the sort of Hinduism versus Islam divide.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's just because it's an architectural marvel in itself. I mean, it's one of the seven wonders of the world.
Do you generally prefer the Mughal era architecture or the traditional Hindu temples?
No, I like them both. You know, I'm very eclectic, so I don't really have any favorites. I even like a lot of the British colonial buildings. A lot of the buildings that the British built, especially in New Delhi, the government buildings. Because even during British rule, Delhi became the capital, so they built these massive, huge government ministries, like imperial buildings, which still impress today. Again, it's Indo-Saracenic architecture with a European touch, but also with an Oriental flavor, so sort of like a hybrid, which I find quite fascinating, to be honest. Gives it a real imperial splendor to Delhi if you walk through this government district and you see these buildings that the British erected during their imperial rule.
So a lot of these cities like New Delhi, well, New Delhi is the capital and it's an imperial city, so there's lots of large parks and plazas and just kind of open areas that you get in a lot of these grand capital cities like London.
Yeah, or Washington even, you know, because even Washington, I think, is one of the most glorious expressions of, say, European imperialism. It's like a real European imperial city. I think Washington is probably the most impressive European imperial city in the world, after Paris, maybe. Well, Paris, Washington, the two most impressive expressions of European imperial splendor. And I think Delhi also to some degree, yes, because it really, you can feel like the European Faustian spirit even in these structures in Delhi.
With the city, so Delhi was, that was created by the Mughals, and then Bombay and Calcutta were founded by the British. So prior to the Mughal invasion, were there any existing major cities?
Yeah, not really big ones, I think. I mean, rather small ones, as far as I know. Because I think, like, for example, Bombay was just a bunch of fishing villages before the British came. And then the British started building everything. So if you walk around Bombay now, especially in the center, like it's all British built stuff. All the buildings, all the original old ones.
What are your general thoughts on the British colonization of India and the legacy of British colonialism on India?
Well, I guess it's a mixed bag, you know. It's like, I guess it brought a lot of progress to India because, I mean, they built the railroad, they introduced the common language, the school system, the legal system, the infrastructure, roads, cities, villages. They got rid of some horrible practices like sati, like the wife burning, like when the husband dies, the living wife has to jump on the funeral pyre of a dead husband. So the British made this practice illegal. The British also stamped out the thuggies, where the English word thug comes from, and the thuggies were a sect of Kali followers that assassinated and murdered people, usually like murder travelers and robbed them, and then I guess sacrificed them to Kali, the goddess of the Hindu goddess of death. They were a big problem. I think the British also got rid of them. So in some ways, I would say that the British had a great civilizing influence on India.
And also, they built the rail infrastructure.
And also roads in general, and cities, like infrastructure in general, and the school system, legal system, etc. But of course, you have to look at it from the Indian perspective. The Indians think, yes, well, this might all be true, but they treated Indians as second-class citizens, which is also true, for hundreds of years, which for a lot of, say, Indian nationalists makes it all irrelevant because they didn't have freedom. You know, so they might have gotten all the stuff, but the average Indian didn't really benefit from it at the time because they were really exploited by the British because the British, say, forced them to import textiles from Britain and crushed the textile industry in India and basically sucked India dry of all the raw material and shipped it to Britain for British factories, etc., thereby impoverishing millions of Indian peasants. I mean, this is what Gandhi was speaking about and rallying against.
And we mentioned the Dalai Lama. I think Gandhi is another figure who was a nationalist, but he gets co-opted by the left. I mean, Gandhi actually said, there's quotes where he was living in Africa and he said some racist things about Africans. So he was primarily an advocate for Indians, but the left in the West has sort of co-opted him as their icon.
Yeah, Gandhi didn't like blacks. And I think a couple of weeks ago, I read on the news on BBC that in Ghana, the African country Ghana, they even removed a statue of Gandhi because of his racist remarks against blacks. Because Gandhi grew up in South Africa, and he was a lawyer in South Africa, and he wanted Indians to be treated the same as white people in apartheid South Africa. But he didn't care that blacks were not treated the same. He only cared about Indians. And, well, then he went to India and became the great liberator of India. But, well, he cared about Indians. He really didn't care. I mean, he was not, like, really, like, in general, like, the anti-colonial struggle, I think. Because I think he really despised blacks, to be honest. So he cared about Indian independence. I suppose Indian independence was achieved also because Gandhi played a big part in it. But a lot of Indian, especially Hindu nationalists today, despise Gandhi, they hate Gandhi, and celebrate the guy who assassinated him because they think that Gandhi betrayed the Hindus by making a deal with Pakistan, with the British, and with the Muslim leaders at the time before independence, and Gandhi facilitated the creation of Pakistan with his support of the Muslims, basically, by saying yes, maybe the Muslims need their own country, etc., and so on. Then the Hindu nationalists view this as a great betrayal of Hindu India, basically, that Gandhi treated the Muslims as equals to Hindus, basically. When, according to Hindu nationalists, like, Muslims should have no say whatsoever in India, because India is a Hindu nation and not a Muslim nation.
What are your general thoughts on the Prime Minister Modi, and what are the primary political divides in India?
I think Modi did some good things, you know. It's like, so far, I mean, yeah, I think he also promoted a lot of progress, and I made some good deals with some countries, like, again, Israel, even with Russia, and so on. But I think the great divide in India now is, I guess you have, like, the secularists and say, the Hindu nationalists. So the Hindu nationalists oppose the Islamification of India, what they view as the Islamification, because it also a lot to do with demographics, I suppose, and growing Muslim population in India, and the fact that Muslims have equal rights, and as far as I know, they even have something like a similar thing to affirmative action in the US, in India, where Muslims are not allowed to be discriminated against, and universities, etc., have to take a certain number of Muslim students, etc., and so on. So all of these people are opposed to this because they see it as an encroachment on the Hindu culture. So that's why you had, like, the BJP was so successful, because a lot of Indians, it resonated with a lot of Hindu Indians, like, because they still view the Muslims as sort of like an alien element in Indian society. It's not just Hindus and Muslims and Parsis. You also have the Buddhists in the north, like in the Himalayas. People, they don't look like Indians at all, and they're Buddhists. And India basically just annexed a lot of these territories in the 1970s and made them part of India. And I've been to a lot of these places, like Sikkim, Meghalaya, Tripura, Ladakh, all these territories and states in the north, in the Himalayan region, also where the tea comes from, like Assam tea and so on. And it's a completely different world. Like, it doesn't feel like India at all. Yeah, because you have, especially in Ladakh, which is part of Kashmir and borders on Tibet, but it's still part of India. So mostly Buddhists, mostly Islandite people. Beautiful landscapes, desert landscapes, because of the altitude, not a lot of vegetation. Beautiful, gorgeous Buddhist monasteries overlooking cliffs. Yeah, I mean, even today, like, it feels like you're traveling back in time when you visit these territories. And
India is very densely populated. What regions have, like, the most spectacular wilderness? Is it mostly the mountain regions near the Himalayas or further up near Kashmir?
Well, that's the one I just mentioned. Ladakh is a part of Kashmir, and spectacular landscapes, because it's like the very high elevation, like very high altitude, desert landscape, because nothing grows, because the air is very thin, and basically it's like an Arizona highway. Like, you see nothing, no villages, no people, nothing for miles on end. Basically, it's just mountains, like gigantic mountains next to you, and desert basically, and a bunch of yaks, and you can eat yak cheese in the restaurants. But you also have, like, you can go to Rajasthan, you can go to the desert there with the camels. You can go to the jungles, you can go to beaches in Goa. So, I mean, you pretty much have everything. But the most impressive landscapes, I would say, can be found in the Himalayas in India, according to my taste.
Konstantin von Hofmeister, it has been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I hope we'll have the chance to talk again very soon.